The headlines: Britain and the European Union are expected to announce a Christmas Eve trade deal after 10 months of Brexit talks. Ukraine's total coronavirus cases surpass the grim milestone of 1 million as its COVID deaths go beyond 17,000. And 150 U.S. House members sign a letter to President-elect Joe Biden, voicing support for the return of the U.S. to the Iran nuclear deal without new conditions. Hello and welcome, everybody. Here in the Iranian capital, Tehran, this is World News. Our top story for this half hour: Britain and the European Union are in last-minute negotiations to reach a post-Brexit trade deal. The two sides are reportedly resolving some small differences over fishing rights. Sources in London and Brussels say the UK and the EU are on the cusp of striking an agreement. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson held a late-night conference call with his senior ministers and negotiators in Brussels over legal texts. He's expected to talk by phone with EU Commission Chief Ursula von der Leyen to seal the deal. The United Kingdom formally left the EU on January the 31st. It has been in a transition period since then, under which rules on trade, travel, and business remain unchanged. But from the end of this year, it will be treated by Brussels as a third country. Europe keeps struggling with the second wave of COVID-19, with daily cases and deaths remaining high in several countries. Russia has confirmed new single-day records of nearly 30,000 cases and 635 deaths in 24 hours. Germany also reported over 32,000 new infections in the same period, pushing its total caseload to over 1.58 million. Germany's new death toll rose by 802 to over 28,000. The country went into a strict lockdown on December 16th to contain the spread of the virus. In Ukraine, the total number of people who have contracted the disease surpassed the 1 million mark. The country also registered over 17,000 deaths. The Ukrainian government has imposed strict measures, including nighttime curfews. China has become the latest country to suspend flights to and from Britain after the European country reported a new, more infectious strain of the coronavirus.
Given the exceptional nature of the virus mutation and its potential impact, and to ensure the healthy travel of Chinese and foreign personnel, China has studied the measures taken by various countries and suspended flights between China and the UK after full assessment.
The official added China will closely monitor the situation and adjust the preventive measures accordingly. More than 40 countries across the world have blocked flights or travel links with the UK. The bans are aimed at halting the spread of the new strain. Scientists have warned that the strain is up to 70% more transmissible. However, there is no evidence it is deadlier. The World Health Organization says new strains are in a rather normal part of the evolution of a pandemic. Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif has reacted to the latest accusations by U.S. President Donald Trump against Tehran. In a Twitter post, Zarif said Trump cannot divert attention from his catastrophic failures at home by putting its own citizens at risk abroad. Zarif made the comment after the U.S. president once again threatened Iran and blamed it for Sunday's rocket attacks on the American embassy in Iraq. Trump said he would hold Tehran responsible for any American deaths. Earlier, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo also made similar remarks, claiming Iran-backed groups had conducted the attack. Tehran dismissed those accusations as irresponsible, saying Washington wants to create tension in the region with false claims. Political commentator David Yavlian says he believes the U.S. president is not interested in starting a war.
Likely President Trump is not interested in generating a war at this point, and this would basically ruin whatever legacy he would have had in not initiating at least any new stupid American wars abroad. But I think the key figure to focus on is the self-declared Christian Zionist zealot Mike Pompeo, who also has future political interests in campaigning in mind, who himself is chomping at the bit to start some sort of open kinetic exchange between Iran and the United States. And his tweet immediately after the rocket attack on the Green Zone, I think, is indicative of his agenda to try to foment as much ill will and potentially violence between Iran and the United States before the Trump regime exits in January. This is a man who has bragged about the training he received in the CIA to lie, cheat, and steal. We must remember, in historical context, the United States has been at war for 226 of its 244 years. That is 94% of its history.
A group of 150 U.S. House Democrats has sent a letter to President-elect Joe Biden urging him to return to the 2015 Iran nuclear deal without preconditions. The jointly signed letter also called on the incoming administration to lift some of the sanctions imposed on Iran by the administration of President Donald Trump. The signatory said diplomatic steps should be taken to restore constraints on Iran's nuclear program and bring both Washington and Tehran to the JCPOA compliance as a starting point for further negotiations. They noted that Trump's withdrawal from the accord had not only impacted U.S. relationships with its key allies, but also diminished Washington's influence on the global stage. The U.S. withdrew from the U.N.-endorsed agreement in 2018 and reimposed unilateral sanctions on Iran. Political commentator Seijiro Takeshita says U.S. President-elect Joe Biden and his Western allies would benefit from a unified approach with Tehran and not against it.
Action that was taken by Mr. Trump in regards to this Iran nuclear deal was extremely dangerous. And not only was it dangerous, but it also truncated a lot of relationship of the allies of the Americans in the Western Hemisphere, which really doesn't make any sense, but that's exactly what he did. So obviously, I think many, you know, conscious, good Americans are all hoping and waiting to repatch, rebuild the bridges that's been burnt down by Mr. Trump, and also that would, you know, mitigate, you know, further frictions and further anxiety in the international affairs that we're facing right now. What Mr. Trump did was he basically almost forced the allies and also the friends of, you know, Iranian economy, like that in technology means in Germany, in trade means France and United Kingdom, all these countries to basically put a distance with Iran, regardless, which basically is trying to isolate Iran into patches, and which certainly is not the good methodology that should be adopted.
Yemen's health minister says more than 3,800 children have been killed in the Saudi-led war on the country. Taha al-Mutawakkil said more than 400,000 children are also suffering from severe malnutrition due to the Saudi aggression and blockade. He slammed Riyadh for targeting Yemen's healthcare infrastructure. He added the country is witnessing an increase in birth defects due to unconventional weapons used by Saudi-led forces. Al-Mutawakkil said the United Nations is complicit in Saudi crimes by removing the kingdom from its child killer blacklist in July. Saudi Arabia launched a devastating war on Yemen in early 2015. Tens of thousands of people, mostly civilians, have been killed in what the UN describes as the worst humanitarian crisis in the world. Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have held a protest rally against the UN decision to reduce its aid services in the impoverished enclave. They say the reduction has negatively impacted their daily lives amid Israeli blockade and pandemic. Ruba Shavit has more in this report.
The Palestinian Refugees Committee in the Gaza Strip organized a rally against the UN AIDS and Health Services reduction. Palestinian refugees who have impacted badly by this reduction participated in the demonstration, calling for the world body's attention to the dire condition in the impoverished enclave.
It's our right to get the UN's aid services. People here are living in a deteriorating condition amid the pandemic. People here can't afford living, and now, with the reduction of the UN aid services, their life is getting even worse.
Palestinians believe the reduction in aid services by the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestinian Refugees, UNRWA, is an attempt by the U.S. to liquidate the humanitarian organization. Earlier, the U.S. announced plans to withhold $65 million of aid to the UNRWA until further notice.
The UN aid services reduction will have dire consequences as it deprives the Palestinian refugees from their basic rights. The reduction comes amid a critical political time as Israel is stepping up its pressure on the Palestinians.
By reducing the refugees' aid, the UN is standing beside the Israeli occupation at the expense of Palestinians' rights. We are calling for our rights, and the UN should fulfill its commitments.
The demonstrators call on the international community to reverse the reduction decision by the UN and keep on supporting the Palestinian refugees who have lost their lands and were expelled since 1948.
The reduction policy aims at reducing the aid services step by step until Palestinians are completely deprived of their rights. The UNRWA was established to help and support Palestinian refugees. The reduction policies serve Israel's interests.
UNRWA was established to aid the 700,000 Palestinians who were expelled from their homes during the war surrounding Israeli occupation's establishment in 1948.
More than the half of the 2 million people in the Gaza Strip are dependent on support from UNRWA, and depriving them from the services they need will worsen the living conditions. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
Israel's parliament has been dissolved after lawmakers failed to pass budget, setting the stage for a fourth election in less than 2 years. Mona Candy has more in this report.
The Knesset, the Israeli parliament, dissolved itself and the unity cabinet collapsed, pushing the Israelis into yet another early election on 23rd of March that would be the fourth in 2 years. The Knesset dispersed after failing to meet the legal deadline for approving a budget for 2020. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of the conservative Likud party had refused to present a budget in violation of his coalition agreement with his main rival turned partner Benny Gantz of the centrist Blue and White party.
The dissolving of the Knesset was simply because of Netanyahu's unwillingness to give up the premiership. The very possible scenario is the return of another political impasse for Israel. So Netanyahu will not be able to form a coalition that's satisfying and acceptable for all parties. We may even witness a fifth election after the upcoming vote.
Experts, however, say the dissolving of the Knesset would have been more advantageous for Netanyahu. It's not only a deep distrust between Netanyahu and Gantz. Netanyahu was gambling on another election in the hope of forming a right-wing religious cabinet that would grant him some kind of immunity from prosecution. Netanyahu's corruption trial is scheduled to move into an intensive evidentiary stage in early 2021, requiring his regular presence in court.
His chances is more than anyone else, and especially that he's now trying to use as well the normalization with the Arab countries and try to use all other means which provided to him by the administration of Trump to avoid the trial and to win the elections and once and for all to end the issue of the trial against him in the case of corruption.
The current cabinet will remain in place in a caretaker capacity until after the election, and the formation of a new cabinet is a process that could take many months. However, the Israelis are convinced that there isn't any guarantee that the fourth election would finally end Israel's internal dogged stalemate.
According to observers, Netanyahu has triggered early elections in an attempt to stay in power beyond his current term. However, they add that Netanyahu's fight for re-election is a difficult battle, mainly as his corruption trial is scheduled to resume with witness testimony next February. Mona Kandi, Occupy, Ramallah.
We're going to go back to a previous story where we had Yemen's health minister announcing that more than 3,800 children have been killed in the Saudi-led war on the country. Our correspondent, Abdul Latif Al-Washami, is joining us now from the Yemeni capital, Sana'a. Abdul Latif, welcome to the program. What do these numbers mean?
These numbers mean that the atrocities and the war crimes of Saudi Arabia against the children of Yemen are countless. They targeted children with airstrikes, 3,800. Children were killed by these airstrikes, and many thousands more were left with disabilities. We have over 2 million children acutely malnourished, and over 400,000 children are severely malnourished and under famine-like conditions. These numbers show to the world the catastrophic situation and dire condition of children in Yemen, and the Ministry of Health is trying to put the world on the image of these catastrophic numbers of children. They are watching silently an entire people, including women and the children, being deprived of their basics of life. We need the blockade to be lifted so we can live again.
All right, thanks a lot. That was our correspondent, Abdul Latif Al-Washabi, joining us from the Yemeni Capital Sana. Elsewhere, an alliance of local parties has emerged victorious in Indian-controlled Kashmir elections. The elections come after India stripped Kashmir's semi-autonomous status last year. Our correspondent, Chanabat, reports from Kashmir.
Amid stringent security measures, counting of votes took place in Kashmir. The alliance of local parties emerged victorious by winning a maximum number of seats in the local administration. The elections in Kashmir come at a time when all the political processes in the region were halted after New Delhi stripped Kashmir's semi-autonomous status in August 2019. India's unilateral decision has not been accepted by the local pro-India political parties in Kashmir, and they aim to fight the decision. Victorious candidates and supporters perceive this win as a victory of people's verdict against what they call BJP's propagandist narrative on Kashmir. Political analyst Gohar Gilani says the results have clearly showed that the people of Kashmir stand by the People's Alliance.
The PAGD wins. They will see it as a referendum for the position that they have taken, which is against the, you know, decisions taken on August 5 last year.
But at the same time, Gauhar Gilani is critical of these local pro-India political parties, considering their track records.
You know, why PAGD participated in the elections? They say that they are there because they do not want to further, you know, give away the political space, whatever little is left there. But at the same time, the counter-argument is when there was political space in their hands, still the New Delhi, still New Delhi did what they wanted to do. They dismissed the chief minister, they removed Sheikh Abdullah as prime minister in 1953 and did what they wanted. They did what they wanted to do in 1960s. So this entire argument is, you know, flawed in many ways. But at the same time, it has somehow broken the ice in a way that there is no stalemate.
After total 280 seats, the People's Alliance is leading, followed by BJP, Indian National Congress, and others.
The local election results in Indian administered Kashmir are seen by many as a new political chapter that would determine the future political discourse of this Muslim majority region. Analysts say, considering the political history of Kashmir, a deep rooted mistrust in New Delhi and local pro India political parties persists, and people here only seem to be choosing the lesser evil. Shahanabad, Indian-administered Kashmir.
The Ethiopian Human Rights Commission says armed men have killed more than 100 people in a village in the west of the country. The government-affiliated body said the pre-dawn attack took place in a village in the Metekel zone, home to multiple ethnic groups. The commission said at least 36 survivors were being treated for bullet and arrow wounds in a hospital. It added the crops were also satellite. A spokesperson for the government blamed anti-peace elements for the attack. On Tuesday, Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed traveled to the region to discuss the ethnic violence in recent months. In a tweet, he said the desire by enemies to divide Ethiopia along ethnic and religious lines still exists. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayaki. In today's show, we're discussing Cowspiracy, directed by Kit Anderson and Keegan Coon. And joining me in the studio, we have Maria Duarte, who is a film critic for the Morning Star newspaper and who has also worked as a news journalist. And beside her is Anthony Hamilton, who is a vegan, SWP member and student activist. Now, Cowspiracy is a groundbreaking documentary that contends that industrial animal agriculture is the leading cause of deforestation, water consumption, pollution, and even plays a far greater role in global warming than the transportation industry. Cowspiracy manages to expose the capitalist nature and the privatization of the Western food industry, which seeks to protect private company owners and large environmental groups that link back to Congress.
Think there should be any concern of us making this documentary?
Of course. If you don't realize right now that you're putting your neck on the chopping block, you know, you better take that camera and throw it away.
It's an environmental disaster that's being ignored by the very people who should be championing.
Let's look at the fundamental problem here.
No one wants to talk about it.
Because they're membership organizations, you know, a lot of them. They're looking to maximize the number of people making contributions.
The leading cause of environmental degradation is...
We need to address that as well.
It's not up to the Department of Water Resources.
Hard to actually target, like, one thing.
I don't necessarily know what it is.
There's suppression and mismanagement of information everywhere, it abounds.
It starts at the local level, but then it goes all the way to Congress.
When you consider the devastation it's having on our planet as well as the oceans.
And we're in the middle of the largest mass extinction of species in 65 million years.
And they can dictate the federal policies because they have so much political power.
They're one of the largest industries on the planet with the biggest environmental impact. Trying to keep us in the dark about how it's operating.
That's the one thing no one talks about. Everybody goes around that.
Unfortunately, we are no longer able to fund your film project. We had a meeting, and due to the growing controversial subject matter, we have some concerns as well.
You're going up against people that have massive legal resources, and you have nothing.
A lot of people just keep their mouths shut because they don't want to be the next one with the bullet to their head.
I don't know that I would want to comment on that.
Well, welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. And I must say, I found this documentary to be very shocking, thought-provoking, and disturbing all at the same time. And you really do feel a great sense of urgency after watching this documentary to address environmental issues. Maria, if I could start with you as our guest film critic. This documentary was re-released a few years ago, but it's still highly watched and highly relevant to today. What was your take on it?
Well, very much so, and everything that you've mentioned, that and all the above and more, really. And it's quite an impressive first-time feature for these guys. And what they do, which is really interesting, is rather than going for meat-eaters and putting them off, which is the obvious thing, they go for the environmental agencies and groups and basically question them as to why they aren't campaigning about this issue, which is greatly affects global warming. I mean, it's pretty shocking. What they also do is, through humour and... sparing shock tactics, get the message across too.
And he's also on a personal journey, as we learn watching this documentary. He gets very involved, and I thought that was a good style.
Yeah, we've seen it with Michael Moore, but here it's less about him and more about keeping on point and on the question. And some of the stuff is really jaw-dropping.
And Anthony, what was your take on the film?
Yeah, I mean,
I really enjoyed it. Like you said, about the lack of shock tactics really then allows you to engage in it without feeling as if you're morally obliged to, you know, have to straight away get behind it without seeing the facts and figures and everything like that. So I thought in that sense, you know, it was quite good. It was very critical of the charities, of the people who are supposed to be doing something about this. It was very critical about the lobbyists as well behind it, trying to show the systematic nature of what's going on. I also do think there were a few problems with it. He does seem to pose a lot of the climate change activists against a lot of what he's actually trying to find out, which I think is, you know, a dangerous pit to fall into. In that he seems to target the people who are challenging climate change already and the, you know, activists against fossil fuels and things like this as being part of the problem because they're not acknowledging so much the, you know, the stuff around the agriculture industry. And I think it's a bit of a problem. A better way to do it would be to actually link the two together and say this should be a united fight.
But of course he implies in the documentary that they're sort of in cahoots perhaps behind the scenes with the political establishment, and that's why they're afraid to speak on this issue. But we'll talk about that a bit more later on. So Maria, if I could just turn to you. Do you think, before watching this documentary, were you aware that the animal agriculture industry had such a profound effect on global warming?
No, I wasn't. And having seen Al Gore's two films, even less so, because he doesn't tackle it either. And in the film, he is the main inspiration for Kip Anderson. And if this is as important, as huge as these filmmakers are saying, and the film is trying to say, then why aren't the likes of Al Gore tackling this or mentioning it, even just one line in his two films?
And Anthony, I mean, before we move on to our next clip, do you think this documentary at least makes meat eaters think twice and think about becoming vegan perhaps?
Yeah, I think it definitely has that, because it shows about, you know, there's a lot of talk about individual responsibility and things like that, but it does break it down in quite very obvious terms, uses a lot of nice infographs and stuff, which actually shows your impact on the world, the impact of the meat industry and so on. So I think it does actually, it's really good at exposing that and actually showing people the evidence and letting them make their choice for themselves as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll have to leave it there just for now.
Clearly, the government did not want to talk about this issue. Their inability to answer, along with the environmental organization's silence on the topic of animal agriculture, made it seem something more was going on. I started doing more investigating on the impacts of livestock and found out the situation was actually worse than I had thought. In 2009, two advisors from the World Bank released an analysis on human-induced greenhouse gases, finding that animal agriculture was responsible not for 18%, as the UN stated, but was actually 51% of all greenhouse gases, 51%, yet all we hear about is burning fossil fuels. This devastating figure is due to clear-cutting rainforests for grazing, respiration, and all the waste animals produce. This makes animal agriculture the number one contributor to human-caused climate change. But not only that, I found out raising animals for food consumes a third of all the planet's fresh water, occupies up to 45% of the Earth's land, is responsible for up to 91% of Amazon destruction, is a leading cause of species extinction, ocean dead zones, and habitat destruction. Yet, the world's largest environmental groups that are supposed to be saving our world didn't mention this anywhere. I had to speak with environmental organizations to find out why they weren't addressing this issue.
Truly some mind-boggling statistics there. Maria, if we could go back to you, do you think the filmmakers were successful in this film in conveying the threats the environment is under?
I think they were. For me, the most shocking was the fact that Greenpeace wouldn't speak to Kip Anderson, which is just mind-boggling. And why these organisations aren't fighting or bringing these subjects onto, you know, tackling the government over it, but that sort of Michael Moore-ish type sort of assault on the Greenpeace's offices spoke volumes. And then the emails that the correspondence that he received saying, "Oh, we're not this time, you know, not we can't help you this time," you know, when this is, you know, a great opportunity for them to talk out, you know, to speak out and say something.
And Anthony, if I could turn to you now and to address the issues, the main issues raised in this documentary. Of course, what is the link between the animal industrial agriculture industry and also the impact it has on global warming?
Well, I mean, a lot of what was just shown in that clip there, you know, the deforestation, the destruction of habitats, the species extinction, all of these things contribute in a major way. And if you consider this industry, it is an industry. It has, you know, huge, huge amounts of waste, huge amounts of pollution, huge amounts of taking up land simply to grow crops to feed the animals who also take up land as well. It's an incredibly destructive cycle that actually does, you know, I mean, it was very interesting when he spoke to the Oceana person and they said about ethical fishing and so on. But I mean, when he talks, he goes through it in detail. There's not really such a thing as the sustainable fishing, which they talk about. Mm-hmm. Every which way in which the industry constantly expands is destructive.
Mm-hmm. It is a myth. That's what he's suggesting in the documentary, yeah. Which is surprising to hear. So are you suggesting, is there a link between capitalism and global warming? I mean, do you think it's our over-consumer society that is to blame for all these unsustainable methods we're taking?
Absolutely. And if you think about the entire fundamental point in capitalism is about overproduction. It's about constant expansion, finding new fields and areas to be able to conquer and dominate and sell to people. And if you look at the meat industry, the agriculture industry, it is one of those industries which is just growing bigger and bigger and bigger every year. And, you know, with globalization comes that then domination of the globe with this, you know, huge empire behind it, huge amount of lobbyist money. I think that's, you know, he goes and challenges a lot of the leaders of, like you said, Greenpeace and so on. I think that's brilliant because holding them to account over it really shows the power that this industry has behind it as well.
Maria, do you think the filmmaker puts off people who eat meat from taking part in helping the environment? Or do you think he does it in a way that's clever for us to help the environment?
No, I think he was quite clever in the way he put it across, because we've seen in other films, you know, where, you know, you see these animals and the way they're treated and in humane conditions and everything. But here he's showing what the consequences are and the effects to us and to our planet and what we're doing. And it does make you sort of self-conscious about it. And I think meat eaters will think twice whether or not the term vegan is another matter. But they will take a harder look at what we're doing to our planet.
I mean, we're told constantly to use less water, to change our light bulbs, to recycle. And Anthony, I mean, shouldn't the onus be on people in positions of power rather than the individual to help combat climate change?
Completely. I mean, the idea about just doing small individual things like taking shorter showers and switching off lights and things, while, you know, it is a good activity to get into, it's not going to create the fundamental change which is actually going to save the planet. The fundamental change needs to come from these mass organisations. It actually needs to come from system change in reality, because the way in which this industry is set up, it is to make profit, it is to expand, and it is to not look at the side effects of what they're actually creating, the consequences, which is, you know, constant heating of the globe, constant destruction of rainforests and so on.
And as this documentary suggests also, when you're up against this mass production machine, it's really futile trying to help the environment on an individual level.
Couldn't understand why the world's largest environmental organizations were not addressing this when their entire mission is to help protect the environment.
But that's the thing too, they say, you know, you use less coal, ride your bike, less meat.
Yeah. I think they focus grouped it and it's a political loser. In terms of, because they're membership organizations, you know, a lot of them. They're looking to maximize the number of people making contributions, and if they get identified as being anti-meat or challenging people on their everyday habits, that's something that's so dear to people that it will hurt with their fundraising.
They do not want to address the primary driving cause of environmental devastation, which is animal agriculture, because they're businesses and they want to make sure that they have a reliable source of funding.
I had invited to a meeting with Al Gore and some years ago now, and made these methane arguments, and he was really pushback. And that's just his argument. It's hard enough to get people to think about CO2. Don't confuse them.
I think that the problem with a lot of organizations that are focused and have a laser focus don't go off message because they don't want to piss off another whole group of people that will make their lives difficult.
Truly sinister things happening behind the scenes there. Maria, so if animal agriculture is a leading cause of global warming, why has there been so much silence about this issue? I mean, do you think, as the documentary suggests, there's a conspiracy or cowspiracy happening here?
but clearly something's happening, and there's a lot of invested interest, according to the film, because the fact that environmental agencies aren't taking up the cause, and that comment about Al Gore was priceless. You know, he's in a great position to have included that in his follow-up to An Inconvenient Truth in an Inconvenient Sequel, and he didn't touch it.
They mentioned that in this documentary, yes, actually, that even Al Gore allegedly didn't want to go there as a politician. He knew that it wouldn't help the cause.
But you have to make it the cause. That's what I couldn't get my head around, you know. And that's the thing about this filmmaker. He keeps on message, and he keeps telling you this, and he keeps showing you, talking to all these different organisations. You know, I understand lobbyists. I'd expect that from them, and to a certain extent from the government. But from environmental groups, you know, that was the shocker.
I was very surprised to watch that also. And Anthony, do you think, as the documentary suggests, that major environmental groups are purposefully turning a blind eye to the effects of animal agriculture on the environment? I mean, do you think they have any vested interests?
It seemed that way. I mean, from the people he tried to talk to, it was constantly evading his questions. There were times when they just went silent and couldn't actually answer his questions. You could tell that they wanted to say something, but it was as if something was stopping them. And I think, you know, there is an unseen power that lies behind these industries, where that pressure, that level of fear that the charities hold over being able to speak out about it is clearly an incredibly pressing issue on them. And I think at the heart of it, one of the things which someone said in the VT just there was that they are businesses and they have funding. And if you look at Kip making this film, he had his funding pulled halfway through the film because they said it was becoming too controversial. You know, as soon as these people, the agriculture industry, feels as if something is going to crush their profits and stop their profits in any way, they straight away jump on top of it and stop it from happening.
And another
interesting was that he tackles one of the pro-agriculture people and says, have you invested money, have you funded Greenpeace or one of those organisations? And she, like, stops dead and says, I'd rather not answer that question, or something along those lines, which kind of suggests that they do.
It speaks volumes. Well, so either they plead ignorance or they're trying to hide something. And Maria, one of the other shocking things we find out from this documentary is the food disparagement law, which effectively gags people from speaking out against the animal industry. In several states, it's a law that makes it easy for food producers to sue their critics for libel. So who knew speaking against the beef industry would land you in so much trouble?
Indeed, yes, that's a $64,000 question. The fact that they went after Oprah and lost, again, speaks volumes to a certain extent. And the fact that she was sued along with Howard Lyman, who says in the film that if that had happened now, speaking the truth, he would have been, he would have lost.
He would have lost, yes. So he's probably lucky that Oprah was behind him on that.
Exactly, or that the Patriot Act wasn't around at that time, maybe.
Were you surprised to know this also, Anthony?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the person who was sued as well alongside Oprah, he himself had ran a farm.
Well, exactly.
A massive, massive farm. And it was him who then actually realised what was going on behind the scenes and tried to speak out about it, just speaking the truth. Mm. And straight away it was clamped down on. And obviously he doing that was an individual. Then it becomes the onus of what are these organisations doing? Actually, they have the clout behind them. They have the membership. They have the power to do something. So it does actually make you think what is going on behind the scenes.
We'll have to pause you there for now. And it was a great discussion.
The animal agriculture industry is one of the most powerful industries on the planet. I think most people in this country are aware of the influence of money and industry on politics. And we really see that clearly on display with this industry in particular. Most people would be shocked to learn that animal rights and environmental activists are the number one domestic terrorism threat, according to the FBI.
And why is that?
It's a difficult question to answer, why these groups are at the top of the FBI's priorities. I think a big part of it is that they, more than really any other social movements today, are directly threatening corporate profits. You know, when we try to find out how factory farms and how animal agriculture is put in the environment, they try to claim exemptions to that information, either under national security terms or public safety, trademark issues, business. It's a business secret. We've seen all these attempts to keep people in the dark about what they're actually doing. You know, one of the largest industries on the planet with the biggest environmental impact, trying to keep us in the dark about how it's operating. Through the Freedom of Information Act, we obtained documents from the Counterterrorism Unit that show they're monitoring lectures, media interviews like this one, my website, my book.
Are we at risk filming this and showing it?
You're going up against people that have massive legal resources. I mean, it's just overwhelming, the amount of money at their disposal. And you have nothing. And I think that fear is a big part of the tactic as well.
Will was right. I was scared. When I learned about the activists being killed in Brazil, I was disturbed, but I felt removed. But to learn about American activists and journalists being targeted by the industry and FBI, by funding being dropped, I was genuinely worried, and it hit close to home. Was this why no one was willing to talk about the issue? I decided to take precautionary measures with all the footage I shot.
We also learned from the documentary that at least 1,000 environmental activists have been killed in Brazil over the last 20 years. Maria, we see Kip Anderson becoming increasingly more nervous and paranoid in the making of this documentary because of what he's up against as he digs deeper. Do you think the filmmakers were brave in making this film?
In some ways, yes. Because once you put your head above the parapet, then, you know, you're in that danger zone. And it's something that's very important, and it's critical that people know about it. So, you know, kudos to them and to him to carry on with making this film, because it's such a vitally important subject. You know.
Do you really think that their lives were at risk, or were they dramatizing it, perhaps?
It's not for me to say. It's hard to say. The fact that the funding was removed, and the fact that the FBI apparently, you know, targets journalists. Isn't a surprise as such, but I don't know that. I'm verdict's still out on that one.
And Anthony, just following from that clip, we hear that according to the FBI, environmental and animal rights activists are considered the number one domestic threat. Why are you surprised to know this?
I was incredibly surprised. Mm. Yeah, I mean, given how explosive the world has become, given how turbulent the times that we live in are, if you consider. I mean, you know, this film was made a few years ago, but there are still so many other pressing issues, where there are mass movements about it, where there are protest groups, where there's everything. It's a surprise to see environmental activists and you know, activists against the agriculture industry being up there at the top. I mean, a lot of the time these are people who are in small groups until it breaks through into a much larger thing, like maybe the People's Climate March and that sort of stuff. But until that happens, they're very small groups of people, so it is quite a shocking thing to hear.
I want to bring in Donald Trump now as we end near the end of the program. I mean, he's been criticized for not taking climate change seriously, and he has a record of making some bold tweets, and he's even claimed in one tweet that perhaps China is responsible for global warming as some sort of conspiracy against the US. Anthony, what do you make of Trump's environmental policies?
I mean, I just don't think he knows what he's talking about, really. He has access to a social media account which has possibly the biggest platform in the world right now, and he's able to say whatever he wants, whatever pops into his head at any time without listening to any advisors. And really, it just seems like he doesn't know anything that he's talking about, and everything is always an external enemy. He never does anything wrong. There's nothing wrong with the United States. You know, when it comes to Kim Jong-un and North Korea as well, it's them who are the aggressive ones with the missiles and everything like that. So it's always, there's someone else that's the problem, and it's he's never able to look inwards.
And Mary, what would you say the ultimate message of this documentary is?
Well, that we should all turn vegan, really, if we want to save the planet.
Mm. So cutting out meat or eating less is not enough, apparently.
Apparently not.
To reverse the damage that has been caused. Well, I'm afraid it was a really great discussion, but we'll have to leave it there for now. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. And thank you to both my guests and to you. I've been Camila Shambiati.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed Imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn, alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Husayn, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. My name is Muhammad, and I'm invited by Brother Mahdi to this segment of the program. Today, I'd like to read to you a passage about Islamic lifestyle according to Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. This passage is extracted from a book titled The Life of Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Baqir, written by the great Iraqi Muslim historian and scholar Allama Baqir Sharif al-Qurashi. This great Muslim scholar and historian was born in 1344 AH in the city of Najaf. He's well known for his books on the biography and conduct of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. Please stay with me. Imam al-Baqir, peace be upon him, praised cleverness. He regarded it as the only source of man's happiness and righteousness. He, peace be upon him, said, "The goodness of all coexistence and living together is a full measure. Two-thirds of the measure are cleverness, and one-third of it is heedlessness. Nothing has a portion of good and righteousness except cleverness. That is because man feigns inattention to the things which he realizes and knows." How wonderful this maxim is. A religious scholar commented on it, saying, "Indeed, it has gathered together all the righteousness of the affairs of the world."
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. Now, talking about the beautiful conversations and dialogues which we find in the historical texts, we find one such conversation between Jabir bin Yazid al-Jufi and Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam. The conversation is quite a long conversation that this student has with his teacher regarding high moral standards and universal ideals which can lead a human being towards perfection. In this conversation between the student and the teacher, the follower and the imam, Imam al-Baqir puts forth a lengthy discussion, but taking just bits and pieces, we find that in one place, Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam says to Jabir, "Supply yourself with provisions from this world through the shortness of hope. Hasten, be quick to seize the purpose during the possibility of opportunity." And there is no possibility like the past days with the soundness of the body. Now, just to explain a little bit about what Imam al-Baqir is saying to his student Jabir bin Yazid al-Jufi, Imam al-Baqir says that supply yourself with the provisions of this world, right, by having a shortness of hope. Now, this lack of hope or this shortness of hope is not hope in the mercy of Allah or hope in the help of Allah or hope in the protection of Allah. No, these are all hopes which we must have. We need to have. This is talking about hope in the materialistic world, hopes in people, that perhaps people will help me. Perhaps the materialistic world will come to me or it will help me. No. Do not put your hopes in people. Do not put your hopes in the materialistic world. Put your hopes in the one who deserves to be put hope forwards, which is Allah. Put your hope in Allah. And then Imam al-Baqir says, hasten to seize the purpose when you have the opportunity. How many times, dear friends, do we lose an opportunity and then regret? And so Imam al-Baqir here says to Jabir bin Yazid al-Jufi, seize the opportunity when it has been given to you. And finally he says, remember that the soundness of your body, meaning your health, there is nothing as important as your health which can help you to achieve your purpose. So while you have health, and may Allah always bless you with good health, make sure to seize the opportunity and put your hope in Allah. Beautiful words in this dialogue between Jabir bin Yazid al-Jufi and Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. I am Atta, the host of the program Dialogue. Now, this moment, I invite you to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Ayyub Rashid. I hope you enjoy this part and stay tuned till the end of today's program.
Imama of Imam al-Baqir was for 19 years. And especially from the time 95 to 114 when he passed away, this time was the time of spreading the knowledge of Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. And the main factors, or one factor specifically, which made Imam al-Baqir to be able to spread the knowledge of Ahlul Bayt to Muslims in generally and in Shias in particular, it was the time of shift of power from Bani Umayyah to Bani Abbas. They were busy fighting against one another. Imam got the opportunity and he started spreading knowledge. When we look today at our maraji, we find that most of the time they are not involved in politics, which we know. Most of the time, our scholars, maraji, they will do exactly as what Imam alayhi salam did. They will take the opportunity. If people are fighting for politics, our scholars will go to teach ulum of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. And this, according to historians, the period was known as Ahadul Infiraj, grace period, when Imam alayhi salam decided to teach specifically the Shia and generally all Muslims, including Abu Hanifa and many other figures, came to learn from him.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
what you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.